thick of it, a profit and loss podcast with Colin Lambert and Galen Stobbs.
Welcome to In the Thick of It, Profit and Losses, a weekly podcast with myself, Colin Lambert, and as always with me is Galen Stobbs, editor. There may be some delays and technical issues this time because the P&L World Tour continues, dear listener. Galen's back in New York from his London trip and I'm in Kuala Lumpur. So I thought, Galen, this week we'd probably kick off with something that sort of has grabbed a lot of attention. And it's actually a positive sort of step forward, in to my mind, in the Mark Johnson case. And that is ACI, the Financial Markets Association, actually saying they are going to submit an amicus brief. The US legal system's mechanisms are a little bit beyond me, I have to say. But my basic understanding of an amicus brief is this is a technical document written by an independent source that explains technical details of the case. To my mind, the jury in the Johnson case clearly didn't know the technicalities of the market. You know, you've got to get 12 of your peers, I guess, to judge you, but it's very difficult when you're dealing with something technical. But I do think we need to give ACI a pat on the back publicly for standing up and supporting one of their, you know, potentially one of their members. Because I think we need to remember, cannot reiterate enough, this is not just about Mark Johnson. This is about their members. It's about dealers past and present and future. And they will not be able to do their job properly, and they probably will not want to deal with US firms, which in turn damages the US market, unless they can feel comfortable that, you know, the issue of pre-hedging, for one, is properly understood. I mean, I think from my point of view, the fact that ACI has done this is good. I think it puts attention on people like ISDA and AFME, who, you know, have been heavily involved in sort of setting regulation and best practices and so on and documentation, and they're remaining silent, whereas ISDA in particular, their documentation is at the front of it. There's no real point in me going on too long about this because I've written about it in my column today, but what's your perspective on how things might pan out over there? Because obviously you're on the ground in New York.
So I agree with you. This is definitely a positive step. I actually had quite a couple of comments and emails and sort of LinkedIn messages from people earlier on kind of asking where are the associations and kind of questioning, you know, what is the point of them if when something like this happens we haven't heard anything. So those same people were kind of messaging me the other day to say, you know, this is a really positive step. This is kind of evidence of good leadership. And this is what kind of an association like ACI should be doing to stand up for its members in the FX industry. When, you know, and I'm not judging the case here, but when perhaps someone in the FX industry has been misunderstood in terms of what they did and their function in the market.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right, because I mean, I do think that there is a basic misunderstanding of a core plank of what happened around this case. And it's interesting because there's another case in the US, and last week Robert Bergucci, I apologize if I've pronounced that name wrong, filed a motion to dismiss the claim against him. He was the former Barclays head of FX in the States, who's been charged with, you know, wire fraud, front running, the usual playlist, relating to a Hewlett-Packard deal. And it was quite interesting to see that his counsel's motion to dismiss was quite aggressive, in as much as it was saying, well, look, hang on a second, the government is trying to argue that this guy had a fiduciary interest to the client when it explicitly stated in three or four documents that there was no fiduciary requirement. There was a basic, an arm's length relationship between two sophisticated counterparties. So on one hand, we've got chats and phone recordings that the US government has used, and obviously they're a prosecution. They've got to lay it on as thick as they can, just as the defense does. It's, you know, it's part of the drama and acting of the courtroom. But on one hand, you've got in the Bergucci case, you've got these texts of, you know, chat rooms and transcripts of phone messages, which look pretty damning. And then on the other hand, you've got a document, a signed legal document, that says, well, actually, we have no fiduciary right to you. I do wonder at some stage if the DOJ in the States will maybe look at this and go, we might have to rethink how we approach these cases, because I'm not convinced at the moment they're doing it the right way. You're right to not. Sorry, go on.
Okay, and speaking of rethinking things there, I think for my mind, in the Q&A you put out this morning regarding this trial, that for me, one of the most interesting things was the answer to the last question, which is if the verdict is upheld on appeal, talking about how perhaps the global foreign exchange committees would have to reconsider the advice and examples given in the global code concerning pre-hedging. And also that it could have implications on the use of ISDA agreements and the concepts of principle-to-principle under trading that underpins FX trading in general, which I think is pretty significant on both cases.
It's quite interesting because I spoke to somebody quite senior who was involved in the drafting of the code, and that person told me that because I raised this issue with them maybe 6-9 months ago, and that person sort of said, well, actually, I think what you might find will happen is the rest of the world will go, well, we're quite happy with the global code and how it works, and if you've got a problem in the US, then you better deal with it. And I guess this is something I wrote about, it's getting late in Malaysia, I wrote about in a column some months ago, when I said, you know, one of the outcomes of this could be that people stop dealing with US counterparties and we have a bifurcated foreign exchange market. And if that happens, well, I know isolationism and fighting their corner is a big thing in the US at the moment, but this would actually, I don't think this will be a positive for the US economy, US banking system, or US corporations. So it's going to be worth watching. I think, you know, it's a very fluid situation. Personally, I think Mark Johnson should not be even considered as going to jail, but I've said that before. We'll wait and see. We'll have to let the legal system do its thing, and hopefully a fair decision is come to. So we'll leave it there, probably. Because I think we need to, you know, move on, because we're looking at past issues. Let's look at the future. And you published a really interesting Q&A, speaking of Q&As, with Justin Slaughter as part of P&L's On the Block. What was your takeaway from that?
Yeah, so for readers who don't know, we've started in New York running a series called On the Block, which is just kind of very small educational seminar type events for buy side market participants here in New York. And we had the session focused on custody and custody solutions entering the market, which is one of the big barriers to institutional adoption of cryptos at the moment. But before that, we did a Q&A with Justin Slaughter from Mercury Strategies, who is, you know, based in Washington and was at the CFTC before his current role. And we talked about kind of everything that's going on with crypto regulation at the moment. And he had some really interesting insights on a lot of what's happening. For example, you know, everybody got very excited when an SEC official said fairly recently that, you know, they're not going to view Ethereum as a security. And whereas he said that's probably an indication of where they're at, you know, I think it was CBOE, obviously very excited to launch Ethereum futures. You know, they put out a notice saying, oh, yes, you know, this is great news. Now we can go ahead with that. Whereas he was kind of saying it's more of, you know, this is how we visualize it at the moment. But he was like, the tempo with things in DC at the moment is going to be 18 months or so before it actually gets, if it gets a green light, it's not going to get a green light. So he's like, it's very much kind of, they're putting on the orange light, get ready to go. But he was like, it's going to happen a lot slower than people think it's going to happen. He also talked about, you know, basically, you know, when it comes to crypto regulation and who's in kind of the, who's got a target on that back for regulators. So it's either kind of the established big players in that market who are kind of what he called the linchpins of the system, you know, Coinbase's, Ethereum, Bitfinex. So those kind of people. Also, he's talking about how the criminal investigations that are taking place, particularly with regards to Tether and Bitfinex, could potentially open a bit of a Pandora's box in terms of regulators piling in. You know, he said that the biggest danger to crypto right now is actually there's a large criminal case, and that causes piling on because criminal action often precedes congressional action, right? So if there is some criminal action, suddenly, you know, politicians and regulators everywhere are going to kind of perk up their ears and say, well, what's happening here? But yeah, no, it was really interesting to hear him discuss kind of all the different areas going on and all the different agencies that are looking at this, agencies that people in financial services traditionally might not have had to deal with before, who, if they want to get into the crypto world, they suddenly might have to deal with on a much more regular basis.
I mean, a couple of things strike me from that. The first thing is 18 months. This is an industry that, to me, is been used to acting very quickly without any regard to the regulators often, of course. But they're used to actually acting quickly and, you know, pretty much going ahead with whatever they want to do. This will be a challenge to quite a few of those firms, I would imagine. The other one is, you know, I don't think, probably less seriously, I don't think the regulators will pile on quite as much as they did in financial markets, because I don't think these guys are quite as rich as the banks. So I don't think there's going to be the sort of revenue streams from the fines from these sort of things if they do pile in. But I mean, do you think that that is actually, do you think regulatory sort of quagmire is maybe a threat to the growth?
I don't right now, because right now regulators seem to have taken quite a pragmatic approach of kind of letting things go, and then if there's a problem, they'll look into it rather than being too preemptive. I would say, yeah, you're right. On the one hand, they don't have the same money, so they might not pile in that regard. But on the other hand, you have to remember, it's still a very retail market, right? So they're worried about the people getting hurt and mum and pop. But some of the financial services firms, if you know, they can go and eat each other's lunch all day, and the regulators won't necessarily care as much.
Yeah, and to be fair to the regulators, that is who they should be looking after. I've always said, yeah, they should worry less about, you know, there should be a consent in adults market, which, you know, historically foreign exchange was a consent in adults market. If you lost money, well, why were you in it? And if you couldn't afford to lose it, you shouldn't be in it. So, and this retailization of markets has created a lot of challenges, I know, but to my mind, this is who the regulators should be looking at. Who is actually impacting, you know, the guys in Wyoming and other places?
And to be fair, I've had some conversations with the regulators who've been very frustrated by this idea that they ought to regulate and be on top of everything in the space. You know, they've been saying quite publicly in some cases, look, if you want to launch this product or you want to do something in this space, right, it's not our duty to get out in front of you and regulate to give you a clear path to build your product, right? You have to work within the existing confines of the system. We don't have to change the system for you.
No, I think that's right. There was something, I guess it's maybe a similar topic to that, is and it's at this stage we give our listeners an insight into the wonder of working with Aradhr and Chief Julie Ross, who casually flicked over a report to Galen and I the other day saying this might be quite an interesting read. And I opened it and it said, on page 165, we have an appendix. It's like, so, Julie, I'm sorry, I've got to be honest, I haven't read all 165 pages. But luckily, Galen has.
I mean, I jumped to the good bits. I looked at the contents page, which had a lot of your favorite phrases, Colin, like digitization.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm all over that, me.
Oh, yeah, there's a section called Embracing Digitization, Data, and Technology, which I know you'll get around to reading at some stage. So this was a report by the U.S. Department of the Treasury about a financial – it's called A Financial System That Creates Economic Opportunities, and then the subheading is Non-Bank Financials, Fintech, and Innovation. And it's kind of more in the retail domain, but it raises kind of a few things that chime with something I've been hearing from other people. Namely, one is about kind of the – it made me think about stuff I've heard recently about non-bank financial players being treated different to banks. And what I mean by that is I spoke to someone who is kind of on the crypto blockchain-y side, but they were in Europe not that long ago, you know, with – you know, the ECB, European Commission, and a lot of big European banks, and they said that one of the complaints that a lot of the European banks were issuing or kind of raising was that there's all these kind of non-bank fintech firms doing, you know, a vast array of jobs, whether it's money transfers or this or that, or cryptos, and it's creating an unfair playing field because all these firms don't have to have the same, you know, compliance, operational structure. You know, they don't have to have all this in place, which is like a huge barrier for the bank. Mm. And don't get me wrong, on the one hand, and they joked about this, they were like, yeah, I know, woe is me, the big, huge banks with resources that these fintechs could only dream of are complaining about this. But I think it still is an interesting point.
It is. The only thing I would say is these, obviously, we feel total sympathy for the banks that are currently reporting profits around the $25 to $30 billion a year mark. I think I kind of get their argument. I mean, you know, as I've said before on this podcast and in my writings, I still believe, I think we said it last week, wasn't it? The threat to the non-bank firm in financial markets is the regulators, not their PB, and the cost of compliance could suddenly rocket. I think we probably are seeing this sort of disruption that everyone talks about so proudly is occurring, but it won't actually disrupt that much. What it will do, I think, is probably bring the major providers into a place where they're going to be cheaper. They're going to provide their services cheaper. And it will probably mean that one or two of these fintechs, these smaller fintechs, will be very successful because they will be adopted by the major players to help them cut costs so that they can give the service at that lower level. I think the argument's fair. I do think there is a fair argument that they are judged by different standards and they're offering the same service. I think the difficult question and the difficult case to make is when the banks say, well, you know, well, they should be treated the same as us. If I'm, and I'll just pick out a random name, if I'm HSBC, I don't know how many clients they've got, but it is a shed load. And if I'm a fintech that's lending to like maybe 3,000 people, it's a different issue. And I think, you know, the regulators look at it and say, why am I going to sort of stifle innovation? Because that's the counter argument, isn't it? They stifle innovation by over-regulating. So, I'm a little bit ambivalent on this one, actually. It's rare for me.
But do you ever see a situation, right, where basically a fin gets, let's say a fintech gets adoption by the big banks, right? You know, not even in competition with them, they adopt that because it's an infrastructure solution. Yeah. It's boring. We've heard about the need for shared infrastructure for ages, even though no one's really doing it. And so they adopt that. All well and good, right? But could we ever then get to a point where major financial institutions have adopted, well, basically a fintech suddenly becomes kind of a hub in the financial system that becomes critically important or systemically important rather.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, if you think about it, I mean, you could possibly question whether it's systemically important, but I would say it's significant. You look at the journey of Triana from startup, you know, fintech, to the platform that handles the messaging relating to probably 30% of foreign exchange volume around the world. There's definitely sort of instances where this can happen. I tend to feel that it will probably come about, if a fintech becomes systemically important, then I think either a consortium or, you know, will be encouraged to probably buy it. And I think, you know, I love listening to fintechs, and a lot of them are my friends who've come out of the banking industry and other industries and so on. But I was talking to a guy here last night, and he's in the fracking game. And he had his own company. He's some sort of analyst. It's very, very clever stuff, apparently, as he was keen to tell me. But he's in the fracking game, and yeah, he was effectively a fintech because he said, I created, you know, a piece of technology that enables the company to do a piece around the fracking much cheaper. And he sort of talking about disruption and, you know, the worthiness of the whole thing. And in the end, I obviously got bored and went,
mate, all you're after is being bought by someone. And he went, funnily enough, that's happened last week. That's why I'm out celebrating tonight. So I think the fintechs, generally speaking, I think, yeah, they'll talk a nice book about being disruptive and being a small kid and changing the world. Ultimately, most of them want to be bought by a big bank or a big organisation so they can just say thank you very much and maybe go and do it again in another industry. You know, you do get serial entrepreneurs who get bored when they succeed. So, I certainly think we can get to a stage where a fintech would be systemically important. I just think the ownership of that fintech would have changed in the interim period.
And speaking of fintechs, I actually had quite a few interesting conversations with people about Symphony, the kind of the messaging, the service that's trying to kind of arguably replace Bloomberg terminals in a lot of cases.
The Brave New World, you mean?
The Brave New World, yeah. And I mean, we did kind of an article, this is actually a few years ago, kind of outlining the case for this, right? And not just kind of simply specifically, but basically for the idea that, only paying for the data you need, right? Or only paying a kind of a more like a flexible model rather than this bundled service model. That was kind of more what the article was about. And as applied to the terminal model, I mean, I've spoken to lots of people who think it's ridiculous how much money they pay for just a chat service. Because even though the Bloomberg terminals have so much information, so much data, and really rich, fantastic functionality, right? So many firms just need a tiny, tiny fraction of that, and yet they kind of have to pay for the whole thing, right? That's the model. Mm. And so on paper, that sounds good, as does kind of the more kind of open source structure, and then it was kind of this consortium model. And so on paper, you could see a strong argument for it, which is why I found it interesting speaking to people in London. And bear in mind, so just looking up now, so Goldman bought the messaging service, which was in a part of a consortium. This was in 2014, right? So yeah, been around for a little while now. And so speaking to people in London, I was kind of asking, oh, so is that, getting traction? Do you see, like, a fundamental threat to the terminal model? And I was surprised by how many people said, oh, yeah, no, we've kind of installed, we've got Symphony up and running, but we haven't got rid of a single Bloomberg terminal. and I was like, what? And they were like, yeah. So the problem is, right? So the problem is, it's the banks can't get rid of, basically, it needs to happen all at once, right? The banks can't get rid of Bloomberg terminals till the buy side does. Brokers can't get rid of Bloomberg terminals till both the banks and the buy side does. And a lot of people on the buy side don't seem in a rush to get rid of it. And I mean, in many ways, the backing that the firms behind Symphony, are huge. It's investors include BlackRock, JPM, Citi, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. They've got a lot of big names behind it. And yet it still hasn't got that much traction. And while, people said to me, look, Symphony isn't expensive, but it isn't free. So rather than actually reducing their costs by enabling them to get rid of Bloomberg terminals, it's actually added to costs in a lot of cases because now they have to have both.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's interesting because when we were over in London together in I know we talked to each other from different parts of the world. We actually were in the same country for a few weeks, weren't we? But when we were in London in February, we were discussing this, and there was a sentiment. I came away with this, with the idea that the sentiment was that there would be a continued challenge to the incumbents in Bloomberg and to a lesser degree Thomson Reuters, but that while Symphony was the headline act, potentially actually Symphony wasn't going to be the disruptor, and that it could actually just sort of, fade away because something else will come in a blazing neon light that would actually wow everybody, and that would be the thing, the service that everyone sort of went towards. I actually don't see anything coming from anywhere else. I don't know about you.
No,
it doesn't seem it, does it?
No, I literally haven't heard anything. I mean, when people talk about someone challenging that model, it's always Symphony that gets mentioned.
Yeah, yeah. But it was interesting back in February, wasn't it, when people were saying, we don't think Symphony's going to do it, but we think something else could. So it might be worth keeping everyone's ears and eyes open for if something is bubbling under the radar there. I don't think it is yet. But in fintech world, somebody could be working on a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the one hand, this does really show the power of kind of the network, well, both the network effect on things like this and also just inertia in financial markets. It's very hard to move from one thing to the other. That being said, I mean, it could well be a case of slow and steady wins the race, right, which is, slowly, and yes, everyone has to run both side by side for a very long time. But then eventually, once everyone has both, it gradually, so it could be one of those things that actually just, whereas people get excited about fintech, like, oh, it's going to come in and disruption, and 2 years from now, no one's going to have Bloomberg terminals. And so it could just be something that takes kind of 15 years rather than 2 years. I don't know. But it was just interesting for me to hear that it's getting traction in terms of like adoption, but it hasn't displaced what it was supposed to displace.
No. I think that one thing I would say just to sort of close out on this bit is that I think you shouldn't underestimate the power of the empire builder within certain institutions, because if there's one thing that people in big institutions are not willing to do, that is to give up any of their resources. They'd rather add and add and add and add. The last thing they want to do is say, oh, yeah, I could do without that, in case people start looking at it and going, well, if you can do without that, let's have a look at what else you can do without. And that's a conversation that no manager enjoys. So I guess, to sort of close this out this week, I'm just looking over my shoulder in my hotel room, and there's this big hairy beast sitting there looking at me menacingly, and it is the 800-pound gorilla. We need to talk about Refinitiv.
Yes, we do.
Thoughts?
Thoughts. So here's I've got lots of thoughts on this, but here's my favorite. My favorite bit of the whole press release was the quote from the firm saying, the new name was created based on feedback from customers and industry influencers on the intrinsic value of the financial and risk business to the industry. Firstly, I would love to see that questionnaire. And secondly, they ask people, what do you think the intrinsic value of financial risk business to the industry? And people went, oh, yeah, Refinitiv, mate, that's the one. Like, I just... I've seen worse names than this, but it just...
It's a challenger to unity. That was a good one.
Well, you know the worst bit as well. Like, some marketing firm will have been paid like $50,000 to kind of go away and do some study and then come back and be like, Refinitiv, mate, done. Gotcha.
Well, I think the good thing is, I mean, I need to talk to that marketing firm because I need to know what the hell an industry influencer is. Because last time I checked, most people in financial markets were a little bit anti-influencers. I was going to be a bit independent and cynical. I've just written it down on my pad, and I'm just wondering if the industry influencers, because obviously it's all about industry influencers, RE, Reuters, FIN, Financial, IT, Refinit, I have no idea what the IV is on the end, the IV. Perhaps it's the IV drop they want to put in the arm of the person that come up with this name. I don't know.
So... For you, the next line in the release that I was reading out explains exactly where the name comes from, Colin. Here we go, this is a quote again. It is a name that aims to blend definitive action in financial markets and a bold focus on the future with a 160-year legacy of excellence as a pioneer in financial technology. I think that should explain, and this I should clear that up for you, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know much about industry influencers, and I have to keep on coming back to that, I know. But I've been speaking to quite a few people who actually are customers of Thomson Reuters, and I kind of think that, they're quite influenced. They should be influenced in their own right. And most people are mystified, as I have to say, am I. And I think that's probably the line we have to draw under it. That's it. unless there is something else you want to add to it, but I'm struggling with it already a bit, to be honest.
I think I'll leave it there.
Okay, well, that's the podcast for this week. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back again next week, and we'll both be on home territory, which will be a first for some time. So we'll speak to you then. Thanks for listening.